Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I hit the ball first time, and there it was in the back of the net.
Motivation, yes. Motivation, motivation, the three M's.
That's perverse. In a football field, with kids watching.
Ladies and gentlemen, England will be playing 4-4-2.
And that, boys, is how to take a penalty.
8-1.
8-bloody-1.
Just saying to your colleague, referee's got me the sack. Thank you ever so much for that, won't you?
Hello and welcome to Beyond the Touchline, the football podcast that's not actually about football. Jacques Derrida said that beyond the touchline there is nothing, but simply by virtue of being a philosopher that was talking about football, he was contributing to something. That something is football culture, and it's football culture this podcast is here to discuss. The film, TV, books, games, music, comics, toys, and anything else that helps make sense of the game we love. On this episode, we're going to be looking at Steve Barron's 2001 film, Mike Bassett, England Manager. But who are we? Well, I'm Seb Patrick, a short-tempered, bespectacled Liverpudlian, suddenly thrust into a role far beyond his experience and capabilities. And as first team coach, on my virtual left, we have a genial yes-man who you could easily imagine hosting an ITV game show in the future. It's Dennis Hurley.
Hello, and thank you for that glowing character endorsement. I'm not sure I can live up to it, but I'll do my best, certainly.
Dennis, our customary quick, no explanation, getting to know you question. Who is your favourite celebrity Arsenal fan?
That is a good question, and it's...
I mean, you don't have to say least favourite, because we know what the answer
absolutely
to that
is. Well, yeah, especially when Osama bin Laden was one of the candidates. It takes some doing to actually outdo him. My favourite... Favourite celebrity Arsenal fan? Oh, really quick. Tony McCoy.
Okay. Well, so if Dennis is the coach, who's the assistant manager? Well, on my virtual right, it's a shady used car salesman who the legal team have asked me to point out definitely does not hold any remotely xenophobic views, David Hartrick.
You know, I genuinely used to work in the motor trade, don't you?
I'd forgotten, but yes.
But I was a mechanic for years rather than a salesman in my, as he leaps to his own defence.
Do you own a trench coat, though?
I used to. That's poor, isn't it? I genuinely used to.
I nearly made your introductory question, do you know what an Opal is? But instead, Dave, which World Cup was the best ever for TV coverage?
Well, they always say the one nearest your 10th birthday is your favourite forever. So you look at Italia 90, which would have been mine, and you had, obviously, that theme tune, and it was great on telly because it were proper times. But, controversially, I'm going to have to go with, I think, Brazil 2014, which was that sort of mix of... we had some really interesting pundits on because they mixed it up a bit, but just being able to have a studio that literally overlooks the beach is a quite wonderful thing for World Cup coverage, I think.
We said no explanation, but I'll allow it because it's an interesting conversation. And I think it's a conversation we're going to have in more depth in lots of different ways over the life of this podcast.
Oh, absolutely.
But we should get on to our actual episode for this time around. But before we get into the meat of the episode, you'll know if you've listened to any of our previous editions that we like to kick things off with a warm-up question, because it's a podcast and that's what podcasts do. So our subject matter this month is Mike Bassett, which is a fictional mockumentary done in the style of classic fly-on-the-wall football docs such as The Impossible Job, and we'll get into that influence an awful lot when we talk about the film. But what I want to ask Dennis and Dave is, if you had the ability to go back in time and select one football team, club or country, and just one season or major tournament cycle to have a fly-on-the-wall documentary crew follow them around, who would it be and why? And Dennis, I'll come to you first.
I have chosen the Chelsea 2015-2016 season, just because there was so much absolute banter going on. From an Arsenal,
and we mean banter in a good way.
Oh, absolutely. the original and best kind of banter. From the very first game at home to Swansea, drawing 2-2 would be funny enough, and it was at the time because I was watching it and hadn't even realised that there was the subplot going on with the manager and the physio beginning a fallout, and it just got better from there. It was there was little bits of intrigue every week. The results were terrible. The players, inverted commas, down tools, and the manager slowly went crazy. And if you're looking for a sequel, Manchester United
2018-2019. Good shout.
Well, what about you then, Dave?
It's with trepidation because we haven't checked our answers with each other beforehand, because I'm worried I'm going to say the same thing as Seb here, but it's got to be England at the 1990 World Cup for me, because obviously it's a period of time that I hold incredibly dear. There are lots of parallels with Mike Bassett, which we will go into, but you know, you've got Gazza at his peak, you've got other players there who are huge characters, you've got these ridiculous things that I've tweeted before, like Nigel Kennedy coming in to play an impromptu concert as they're all eating their dinner, and there's footage of it that was ripped from an episode of Saint Agreevesy, and you can imagine how impressed they all are to be listening to a bloke violin in. And just some of the stories that have come out. There's the famous Gazza Doug Ellis story, which I've tweeted, which I won't go into, but if you go onto my Twitter feed, you'll see it as my pinned tweet, which is just incredible. Just gets better and better. And there's all the stuff, you know, Gazza playing tennis in the midday sun on the day of the semi-final because he thought it would be a good idea and he was bored, and some of the stuff Brian Robson got up to that unfortunately got him sent home in the end. And yeah, just a crazy little period of time, really. It would have been fascinating to have access to it all.
I wasn't aware of the Brian Robson stuff. Is it broadcastable?
Well, there's always been this big thing about how he got injured and had to and got sent home, and there are about three versions of the story, and as more time has gone on, it's become very clear that the version of the story is not that he did it in training, it's not that he did his toe going up a set of steps, it's that he got absolutely shit-faced with Gazza and a couple of others, and they were mucking around in one of their rooms, and he had managed to get... basically, somebody dropped the bed on his foot, which is not advisable when you're at a World Cup, and broke a bone in his foot.
Jesus.
That person may or may not have been Paul Gascoigne.
So why wasn't Gazza sent home? So for being the big donkey.
Because basically, I think the long and short of it was the reason all these stories exist is because they never admit they shouldn't have been drunk in the first place, so they never admitted it to the medical team.
Okay.
So it became, oh, I got a knock in training yesterday, and it just seems to have miraculously flared up after about a million bottles of Peroni. But that, you know, that is one story of a great many stories from that tournament. And there's a book, Dennis, which... it's my favourite book of all time. It's all played out by Pete Davis, who bizarrely is now runs the fruit and veg counter at my local Sainsbury's. But it's incredible because he has access to the England camp. And when I say he has access to the England camp, he's literally wandering in and having a swim in the swimming pool next to John Barnes and stuff like that. It's just like crazy looking back at it now. But yeah, that would have been an eventful few weeks to have been with that squad.
Yeah, I'd heard of All Played Out. I've never read it, but I'll certainly put it on my list.
The thing is, like, without going off and going off on a tangent here, All Played Out is the book I recommend to everyone.
Okay.
I get asked a lot because of the day job and everything, you know, what is the best football book of all time? I genuinely, in my heart of hearts, believe that is the best football book of all time. And it's no coincidence that it's not really about football, you know, as we sit here doing this podcast, is right in that wheelhouse, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Well, actually, no, I hadn't picked that, but I wasn't a million miles away. I had picked a World Cup in the 1990s, but I had picked the Republic of Ireland squad at USA 94, because I think you can never have enough footage of USA 94 and everything that happened there and the look of it and the feel of it and the atmosphere of it. Everything that went on with Ireland at that World Cup, from the win over Italy to the John Aldridge madness against Mexico, who wouldn't want to see more and more angles of that incident over and over again? And I think as well, just looking at that Ireland squad in terms of personalities, if you're looking at a documentary to follow them around, I think that Ireland squad is in that perfect sweet spot. Because you've got kind of still some of the old hands, you know, you've got Bonner, you've got Dennis Irwin, you've got Houghton, you've got Aldridge, Staunton, but you've got Paul McGrath, obviously, but you've got Roy Keane, you've got Jason McAtee in there, always going to be fun in a fly on the wall documentary. So I just think, yeah, I think that would be an awful lot of fun. I am kind of surprised that Dennis didn't go for that, but maybe it was a bit too obvious.
Well, if I was going to choose an Ireland World Cup fly on the wall one, it would have obviously been 2002 and Keane.
Oh, well, I was going to say, because then you can do the sequel and do 2002 as well. So, yeah. I think showing those as the two ends of a story, I think.
Well, I suppose I just probably don't want to be seen as a professional Irishman in this in this podcast.
I think it's a bit too late for that. I've got to say, Dave, I mean, everything you said is not without appeal. I just think, especially given that you've already made the case that it's been so well covered in a book, I do think England at Italia 90 is already one of the most covered things in football. And are we wasting that time travel fly on the wall opportunity when we already have so much footage and so much anecdote and oral history of it? For that reason, I'm gonna give this one to Dennis, because the more I think about it, even though it is just a Chelsea Premier League season, I'd like to be a fly on the wall with Jose Mourinho getting sacked. I'd certainly like to be a fly on the wall for all of the happening and then the fallout of the Eva Carneiro incident. In fact, I think that's probably what you'd hinge the entire thing around. I'd really want to see more of that, because I basically just want to see Mourinho squirming. Plus, after all of it, you also get half a season of a documentary of Gus Hiddink. So I think there's entertainment value all around in that. I think we'd need to have maybe also sent the cameras to Leicester on occasion just to catch a little bit of that. But otherwise, I think I'd quite like to see that.
It ends with Eva Carneiro's wedding, I suppose, is the...
It's a disgrace, this. Since we've started this podcast, the only one of these I've won was a victory I awarded myself.
We're doing a Brian Glover from Kez.
You've also made it, Dave, so that nobody else can give the win to themselves again, because it just comes across.
Oh, don't you worry, I'll give the win to myself again.
Well, speaking of people who would probably give wins to themselves if they could, that's not a very good segue. I'm going to take it anyway. Let's move on to our main subject matter for this episode. As we've already mentioned a couple of times, on this edition we're going back to movies. We're looking at the 2001 film Mike Bassett, England Manager. But before we go any further, let's take a listen to a clip from the film.
Half time in La Bombonera Stadium, and England trail Mexico by 2-0.
Have you ever got the clown of shouting, bastards are bastards, bastards are they shouldn't be shouting at me, they should be shouting at you, and you know why? Because it's f***ing half-time, and we're f***ing 2-0 down to the f***ing Mexicans! F***ing wrong with you! Get your f***ing fingers out! Where's your bottle f***ing gone? I can't f***ing pay attention when I'm f***ing talking to you! If you don't want to wear the shit, get off! There's f***ing thousands of kids out there who f***ing die and put that f***ing shit on! F***ing back on the field, show me what you can f***ing do, or f***ing off home on a plane! You got that?
England lose 4-0.
So, Mike Bassett, England manager, was written by John R. Smith and Rob Sprackling, directed by Steve Barron, best known probably at that point for directing the 1990 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie. And it stars Ricky Tomlinson, Amanda Redman, Bradley Walsh, Philip Jackson, Dean Lennox-Kenny, Phil Jupitus and Martin Bashir playing himself. It was released in September 2001, earned a box office total of just under £3.5 million, and doesn't have enough reviews on Rotten Tomatoes to have a score on there, but it's rated at an average of 6.9 out of 10 on IMDb. Now, I do a lot of podcasts about films, and in them we usually try to run through the events of the film chronologically and discuss them as they come. But this always ends up involving spending about an hour and a half talking about the first 45 minutes and then struggling to cram in the remainder. So what we're going to do here is give you a quick synopsis of what happens in the film from start to finish, in case you've forgotten or even if you're listening to us not having seen it, and then we can delve into some discussion points. So, Dave, if you'd like to do the honours.
Ahead of the 2002 World Cup in Brazil, England manager Phil Cope suffers a near-fatal heart attack. With three games of the qualifying campaign to go, the FA desperately look for a successor, but can't find a Premier League or Continental manager willing to take the job. So they turn to Mike Bassett, a journeyman player-turned-manager who's just won the League Cup with Norwich, here sponsored by Mr. Clutch, which is a lovely touch I like. Bassett brings his trusted backroom staff of Lonnie Urquhart and Dave Dodds with him and recalls mercurial, hard-drinking midfielder Kevin Tonka Tonkinson to the squad as England look to secure the 3 points they need to ensure qualification. From the outset, Bassett insists that a traditional 4-4-2 formation will be the best route to success. In their first qualifier against Poland at Wembley, Tonka scores an early goal to give England the lead, but they ultimately lose 2-1. Bassett attempts to give the squad a boost by taking them to an experimental sports science centre, but a series of mishaps severely depletes the squad, who then go on to lose 3-0 away to Belgium. The ensuing negative attention from the press and fans puts a strain on Bassett's family life, while Tonka is arrested for drunk driving. In the final home game at home to Slovenia, England labour to a 0-0 draw. However, a surprise 2-0 win for Luxembourg over Turkey sees England miraculously qualify for the World Cup anyway. A buoyant England head to Brazil, but their first group game is a tedious 0-0 draw with Egypt. Continuing to experiment with new formations, England then lose 4-0 against Mexico. Things go from bad to worse when Mike's wife and son move out of the family home, while Lonnie is sacked after punching Mike in the face during an argument. After a drunken night out with Tonka is captured by the tabloids, Mike is called to a press conference where he's expected to resign, but instead dramatically announces in a Rudyard Kipling-inspired speech that he'll be staying on as manager, and that England will be returning to their 4-4-2 formation for the final group game against old enemy Argentina. We will come back to him returning to that 4-4-2 formation. The Argentina match arrives and England once again look to be playing out a 0-0 draw until Tonka is brought off the bench with minutes to spare. The talismanic midfielder scores a controversial late winner that sees him combine both aspects of Diego Maradona's famous 1986 goals, putting England through to the knockout stages. Following this triumph, we're told that a resurgent England make it all the way to the semi-finals before being beaten by eventual champions Brazil. On the plane home, Bassett reflects on how he might now step down from the job before a glorious reception from the waiting England fans and his family convinces him to stay on for the next 4 years.
Thank you, Dave. Very well put. Okay, so I don't think it's any secret that Dave and I are already very, very familiar with this film, and I don't think we've made a secret of our opinions of it on the podcast prior to now. But Dennis, you had not seen the film before watching it to do on this very podcast, so I'm really interested to just hear initially your opinions and your, before we kind of get into specific details, just your general reaction to this film. What did you think of it?
I at the risk of being excluded from the gang, I would say that the IMDb rating is accurate or maybe slightly generous. And maybe it's the fact that it's taken me 18 years to get around to seeing it, and it's not as fresh, or it's not as how would I put it, you know, it not as original maybe as it was back then, you know, when it probably would have had more of an impact on me. Like, I enjoyed it. I don't dislike it, but I probably won't be watching it again, if that doesn't sound too harsh.
Did you find it funny?
There were bits I laughed at, and there were bits I groaned at.
Okay.
Yeah, I had already heard about the Benson and Hedges joke. I remember hearing that at the time. there were bits that did make me laugh, definitely. Like, when in his first press conference, where he's asked about his capabilities, and he says, "Look at all the other people who've done it, and look how badly they did." What was it? The phrase "licorice arsehole" definitely drew a smile, and three across the middle, and one in bloody Pentonville. Yeah.
Well, let's not do too many of the jokes now, because I want to come on to favourite bits later. But from the sound of it, those are going to be your only ones. So
yeah, it's probably just me watching it too late, I think, is the problem here.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, Dave, so now that we're just a two-person podcast, cheer me up and tell me about your feelings on the film and also your history with it. I presume you watched it a fair bit longer ago than Dennis, but did you watch it when it originally came out?
Yes, I did, yeah. I think we need to talk about the marketing of this film, which I know is probably something Dennis is not going to be able to contribute much on, but the marketing for this film, as we'll come on to, is terrible. So I went into it not really expecting what it is, which is it's a far more intelligent pastiche of English football than people give it credit for. We'll come on to specifics, but things like the depiction of the FA and the depiction of the press pack and, Mike imploring the press to get behind England at times and stuff. There were real-life parallels there. Now, the thing about that is I've sort of discovered and really looked into those aspects with, you know, I don't know how many viewings I'm on now, probably certainly into double figures by quite an embarrassing amount, I'm afraid, Dennis. But the one thing I like about it is I still think it's genuinely funny. And I've watched this with my wife, who dislikes football an enormous amount. And, you know, even she was giggling along. It just, It's an hour and 20 minutes long. It never outstays its welcome. I think the majority of the jokes that landed when I first watched it still land now exactly the same way. I think Ricky Tomlinson is absolutely superb in it. I think it's a really, really good performance. There's one or two rather wooden performances around him. This is quite early in Bradley Walsh's acting career. he's a very decent actor now, in my personal opinion.
He hasn't hit his Doctor Who heights here.
No.
And I don't mean that sarcastically. He's fantastic in Doctor Who.
Yeah, at this stage, he is insanely wooden at times. But I think it's far cleverer than people give it credit for. And I think you've also got to give it credit for some of the football action, which we'll go into a bit more detail on. And I think they're enormously helped by having Mr. Teckers himself, Andy Anser, as the football consultant on it. And I think the more times I've seen it, you sort of appreciate the work that's gone into it to capture some of the subtleties. So, you know, Dennis will do approximately 40 to 45 minutes later about the admirable kit and training wear that England used for this tournament. But it's just the little things like that where the things they've created, the way they work in the footage of the old Wembley and the England-Germany game in particular, and the crowd from that game, and the goal, etc. I just think it's one of those films that it never had a massive budget. It was marketed wrong, but it still, I don't know, I personally think it still stands up incredibly well. And I know didn't you create a completely different potential DVD cover for it?
we'll stick that on Twitter when we publish the episode, because I don't disagree with pretty much anything you've said there. I feel very sad. I didn't actually see it at the time that it came out, and I don't know if I was put off by the marketing or just if it came out. I mean, I would have been at or going to university when it came out, and I didn't go and see a lot of films then because, you know, I didn't have any money. But I remember watching it probably about 4 or 5 years after it had come out. I remember renting it on DVD. And I definitely had an expectation of what it would probably be like based on that dreadful marketing, that dreadful cover, that dreadful tagline. And we can launch into that in a minute, because I think it is worth talking about up top. And ever since then, you know, like you, I've watched it many times because I find it a really comforting film to watch, because I know I'm always going to enjoy it, because, yeah, it does always make me laugh. Yes, there are a lot of quite cheesy gags in it. It does fall foul of, you know, kind of a lot of the traps that kind of British comedy, particularly of that era, would fall into. But I don't think it does it that often. And I think what's so great is that you've got a combination of, you've got jokes that are about football and specifically, and again, we will kind of get into this, but it's not just jokes that are just about football generally. It's jokes that are specifically about the history of English football. Yeah. So they make me laugh. But, you know, there are actually just kind of pure comedy bits that make me laugh as well. You know, I do think Dean Lennox Kelly overdoes it a little bit in places, but I will never not laugh at him saying, "Oh, bollocks, I've shit myself," when he's in the juice. You know, I find it funny all the way through, and I enjoy that it is this kind of this affectionate, well-made football world. And yeah, what really, really bugs me is that it was sold in 2001 as a British comedy kind of that era, and we were in this kind of post Trainspotting, Notting Hill sort of British film and British comedy film was kind of thriving for a while, but then that led to a lot of bad ones being made as well, and a lot of bad comedies. So yeah, you know, you'd had Trainspotting in 96, you'd had The Full Monty in 97, you'd had Lockstock in 98, Sliding Doors, Shakespeare in Love, East is East. But then sort of at around the turn of the century, aside from the fact that you'd had Notting Hill in 99 and Billy Elliot in 2000, you'd also had things like Gregory's Two Girls, Guesthouse Paradiso, the really not very good bottom movie, Kevin and Perry Go Large. You know, you had all these kind of these bad spin-off type things. You had Bridget Jones in 2001, Parole Officer, which isn't terrible but isn't great. So, you know, there is just that thing of a lot of money and a lot of attention was getting thrown at a lot of British comedies at the turn of the century. It would reach its nadir with Sex Lives of the Potato Men, which is the infamous, like, worst comedy film ever made that came out in 2004. But then Shaun of the Dead came out in 2004 and sort of heralded a sort of new direction for British comedy films. And I think with the stuff that was going on around it, with the fact that Ricky Tomlinson was fresh off the Royal Family, I think the Royal Family must have had their second or even third series by that point. So he was very much in the public eye for playing that character and for, you know, I love the Royal Family, but I think it did get Ricky Tomlinson a reputation for being a sort of sweary, you know, kind of comedy actor type who would just get thrown into lots of things. And the cover and the poster in which they just, it's just four shots of Mike where they've given him four different David Beckham inspired haircuts. And it's just, and I think it's like the tagline is something like the ever-changing face of English football has got a new mug.
Mm.
And it's just meaningless. It's just terrible design. And that's like, that poster and that DVD cover is like the only marketing for it. And I just don't understand how you don't take this film and market it as, here is a comedy for people who love football that will be full of jokes that they will get that's about football. Oh, and also, by the way, it features probably the best ever shot football action in a film, at least at that level. I know, Dave, you're going to talk about things like Jimmy Grimble, but I think as a film that shows football at the top level being acted, I don't think there's a film better than this. And I don't know why you don't play up those attributes. The other thing, so I designed a kind of alternative DVD cover to print out for it that's just, it's fairly simple, but it's just, I just think it reflects the film better than the real marketing. But I am very pleased with the tagline that I came up for, which is, the impossible job just got harder.
Yeah, the marketing made it look like a real farce, you know, knockabout comedy, and it's not, it's there's actually more to it than that. And you've done well, really, Dennis, to sort of avoid all of that, because it was impossible not to have a preconception or two, really.
What I'd say is that the lack of marketing, or as Sib says, the bad marketing, probably was a factor in me not going out of my way to ever watch it.
Yeah, and I think that's true of a lot of people, and that's a real shame.
I do have in my notes, I did take note the fact that the action scenes were very good, certainly compared to what was, you know, what you'd see at the time, you know, like Dream Team or the likes of that. It was certainly a cut above that.
Yeah, well, that is, you. I mean, that has led us on to what was actually one of the first things that I wanted to talk about as a specific, which is the veracity of the film, and we have already touched on it a bit. But so if you put aside for a second the historical stuff and the parallels, which we're going to come to, I think if you just look at this film purely as how well does this film put football on screen, and I mean in terms of how it's shot, and I also mean the kind of, obviously it has to build a world for itself, it has to do things like, Dennis, this is where you'll come in, kits and squad numbers and, you know, fictional players and a football universe to live in. I mean, how do you think it compares to other attempts to put football on the screen, putting it aside as a comedy and as a parody, just purely as a football film, where do you think this sits in relation to others?
I would say, like, completely sitting on the fence, better in some regards and then worse than others. And I've tried not to sound like a complete kit nerd or pedant, but the presentation is very important with something like this. And, you know, it's the England national team and they look like a Sunday league team. I think the fact that, you know, you don't have the Three Lions crest, just take something.
It's the lack of badge, isn't it? Yeah,
like it looks like a Pro Evo kit.
I mean, it does look like a Pro Evo kit, but I do kind of, I think they've done the best they probably could in the circumstances of not being able to have a license.
Yeah.
And I wonder actually as well, bearing in mind that this film did have cooperation to shoot in places like Wembley just before it got knocked down and Lancaster Gate just before, as they were moving
and
out.
Bisham Abbey.
And Bisham Abbey, yeah. And I wonder if part of it was, like, I find it interesting that the kit is not white and navy, it's white and black, which is probably my main issue with it, because it makes it look more like a Germany kit, even with the red numbers. But I do wonder if they were kind of forced into that. It was like, you can't make them look too much like the real England.
Yeah.
I at least like that there's consistency, though. Like, internally, there is consistency. The kits are always right in the world that you're in, I think.
Well, England playing Argentina with both teams in home kits was something that grated with me a little bit, I have to admit.
I can see that. Yeah.
Or even the fact that England were playing in squad numbers in a qualifier, which even to the present day, they're still one of the only few teams who still play 1 to 11. And I realise I sound like such a nerd, you know, pissing on these aspects of it, but the whole thing has to knit together, I think, just from an optical point of view. Even the fact, and this is like, this is way beyond the pale, but the fact that, you know, it listed the players and showed their details and listed the honours won, and you had two guys both at Man United who had different sets of honours even though they were there at the same time. Like,
they've been there for the same duration, though.
Yeah, but like, they will say they both won the league in 97 and 2000 or whatever, and then only one had the UEFA Cup in 99. And I don't mind changing the honours won in real life. And maybe it was the case that one had a season-long injury and missed the UEFA Cup final. But it at the same time, it could just be sloppiness. Like saying Alf Ramsey played 4-4-2, which did stick out like a sore thumb to me. But... you know, these are uber nerdy kind of points, so I don't want to... On the flip side, I'll give it credit in that I didn't know that that they used the Vauxhall Astra as a base for one of their cars.
The thing is, though, Dennis, the stuff you point out I think is actually valid, because there's a weird thing where I think there's choices made by a director and editor and choices made by the writers, because there are some really like fantastically detailed gags in there. So like, for instance, I assume I'm not giving them more credit than they deserve, but like the gag about splitting training into two sides, you know, the half of the year and then the first half of the month.
That's a great
where that comes from is there's quite a rich history. If you go back to the very sort of origins of football, that what they used to do they didn't used to pick the teams, they used to split them like smokers against non-smokers. And stuff like that. And that sort of gag has definitely come from that sort of place. So you're quite right. Those little fine details do sometimes grate a bit, because you have got this level of detail where you have got, you know, Bishop Abbey, you have got the old Wembley, like you say, and everything else. So I get that, Dennis. I get that. But
I will give credit even for the fact that all the players are born in the first half of the year, which, like, you know, that's a theory that has some basis, that the guys born in the earlier part of the year, you know, were bigger and stronger at underage level and so stood out more and advanced more. Like, if it's featured in Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell and various other books. So, you know, I was even giving credit for that in my notes as well. Like that, like you say, there are these nice little touches that, you know, that football fans will get.
Another one that I love is when they're doing the pictures of Mike's football career, they're all from Panini stickers. Some of them I recognise, and a couple that I've never been able to completely track down. One of them is actually a Sam Allardyce sticker. And you can imagine the Photoshop work required was fairly minimal.
Yeah. And even just the fact that the house is like the house someone involved in football at the time would have lived in, you know. I can't actually, you know, express that or articulate it any better, but it just seemed right.
Yeah, I mean, Dave, how do you, with sort of the match action, which, as I say, you know, I think really is, I mean, there's not loads of it in the film, but I think what there is a real selling point for the film, because this does something that I don't really see a lot in films, which is that it does show you the actors themselves running and dribbling and tackling each other and shooting past goalkeepers. And it never looks too staged or unrealistic to me compared with other ones that we've seen. What do you think?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that Dean Lennox Kelly is actually a very good footballer. You can see that. You can see from the way he moves. So that helps an enormous amount when Tonka's on the ball. But there's often like two ways of approaching match action. So the first is where you get like a When Saturday Comes, where you get this horribly jarring blend of acted football. Mm. And blended into like a real life FA Cup tie against Manchester United, and it just doesn't work. Whereas what you've got here is, I quite like the film Mean Machine. Please keep listening to the football podcast that we're on now. Please, it is an admission. I quite like that. But what they did to get the football there is they only had a couple of action sections that they wanted to specifically capture, but they played to get the rest of the action. They literally played every other day for like a fortnight, a 90-minute game of football. So they recorded all that footage so they could get loads of stuff out of it. And I get the feeling here with quite a few shots that there were specific beats to hit, but with some of the other action, they were literally just playing football.
Mm.
And that is, you know, I think that is probably the best way to capture football, because it's not scripted, is it?
Mm.
But even the shot behind the goal in the Poland game is Hamann's free
kick.
It's
the Germany goal. I was going to ask if you knew that. Yeah, that's why they use a bit of real. Yeah,
that's why England's goalkeeper throughout has to have a ponytail. It's got to match up with that. And that level of detail to be able to get a shot like that, I think is clever. I think it's a clever way to do it. The other thing they do throughout, without getting too nerdy in sort of the mechanics of film, they find lots of ways to cleverly keep shots very narrow. Mm. So you've got, you know, like when what's his name, Wacker
gets sent mad off.
And it's you see it on the security camera footage, you know, it switches to security cam. You get lots of shots of Mike sort of looking out, like in when they're at the World Cup and they're in the lower dugout. I mean, when have you ever seen a lower dugout at a World Cup stadium? But what it allows you to do is like keep that nice tight cropped shot, have a green screen behind so you can drop a crowd there as and when you need it. You give a viewpoint where you can look out and not necessarily have to see the entire of the pitch. So I think they're actually very, very clever in the way that they film it. And I mean, like Dennis mentioned, some of the football that was being filmed around this time, like Dream Team and what have you, was dreadful. I mean, it really was, because, as I said, as soon as the football becomes scripted, it's almost impossible for it not to stand out like a sore thumb. But yeah, I think it's particularly well captured, really.
I think it probably helps that you don't have to see many goals scored in this film, because one of the problems that films always have, and we've discussed it on previous episodes, and particularly when we're talking about it on Goal TV, is goalkeepers are really difficult to film, and it's hard to film a goal going in that looks like the goalkeeper has tried to save it. And actually, in this film, we see England get scored against by Poland, but it's footage of the Germany goal. We see England score against Poland, which is an interesting thing I realised on watching this for this podcast, which I'd never realised on my many viewings, is England only score two goals in the entire narrative of this film. And it's the very first goal in the film and the very last goal in the film, and they're both scored by Tonka. But you have Tonka's first goal is, I think, the only goal that you properly see scored from a kind of TV type angle.
And
I think the director says on the commentary that it was about the 17th take to get him to do that. But it looks realistic.
It looks really good, yeah.
But I think by minimising how much they have to do that, because other than that, you've got that Poland goal, which is real footage. You've got the handball goal, which obviously is an unusual goal, so can look weird. And you've got the goal that they shoot, the own goal for Scotland against Ethiopia was specially shot as well, But again, that's a farcical comedy goal, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we'll come to that when we talk about favourite moments in the film. But they make a clever decision with a handball goal as well, because they make the ball come back far enough off the crossbar so that the keeper's... He's got no chance of getting there, because the closer you have Tonka and the keeper, the more unrealistic it's going to look. So the fact that the keeper is doing nothing but just sort of flailing out there, and Tonka's handball is even better for the fact that it's actually completely unnecessary, because you can clearly see he could head that, no problem whatsoever. That for me anyway, that's, again, it's quite a clever decision, because you're almost taking one half of it completely out. You know, so when you do have to script football, the less pieces on the chessboard you can have, the better, to be perfectly honest with you, because the more people involved, the worse it is invariably.
Just one more thing on the filming, because you mentioned the kind of cleverness of having to do all these kind of tight shots and work around things. I think it is just worth kind of briefly summarising, and for people who kind of don't know the specifics, I mean, people who haven't sat there and watched it with Steve Barron's commentary like I have. But, you know, the lengths they went to kind of capture the footage, obviously, I think it is quite well known that they shot at Wembley after Wembley had been closed and before it got knocked down. They had to relay the pitch. But they, you know, so they shot match action on the pitch at Wembley. They got fans in a particular corner and then blended it with a combination of actual England fan footage from other games and computer-generated fans to fill the stadium. But what impressed me was that for the World Cup, they went to the Maracanã. And they did actually shoot there, and the stuff with them at the dugouts and stuff, it was shot there. But they did a combination of, they were allowed on the pitch, I think, for a total of about half an hour to film, but all of the other stuff, basically what they managed to capture was, there was a match going on and they were allowed to spend a bit of time while there was a match on filming the characters at the sidelines, so they could capture footage that they could then blend in. And I just think throughout, and again, there's other moments as well, I think what this film shows throughout is a really good sense of, it's aware of the resources that it has and the limitations of the resources that it has. And I think there's so much clever lateral thinking that goes into stitching together what they have into something that feels coherent. And I think, and again, we will come to it in more detail, but I think particularly when they go to Brazil, there's just a really strong feel to it. It feels right. It feels like a World Cup. I think my favourite bit of match footage is actually the 0-0 draw against Egypt.
Yeah.
That beautiful slow motion, boring bit of footage that just, it gets across so strongly what it feels like to watch a boring game in a World Cup. I just think that, yeah, just, you know, just it feels like football, this film, more than I think any other. But Dave, it's, as well as feeling generally like football, there is so much in this film that is so specific. And I think, I wonder if part of the problem in terms of people not regarding it highly is if people watch it and a lot of those jokes and references go over their head. So let's dig into a bit of that. Talk me through some of the ways in which this film is making incredibly specific and funny jokes about the history of English football.
Well, Before anything else, you just look at the structure of it. If anybody has seen the Graham Taylor documentary, this Mike Bassett is essentially supposed to be a sequel to it. The narration is in the same style. The Graham Taylor Impossible Job opens with the Bill Shankly quote, you know, white written on a black background. We get the quotes in Mike Bassett. So there is a direct parallel that makes me smile right from the off there anyway. Then you've got the depiction of the FA and the depiction of the FA as a bunch of old white men in a boardroom smoking,
falling asleep,
doodling on pitches of paper, etc. is, you know, let's be honest, we're in 2019, a lot has changed. That would not be a fair comparison now. But at that point, I mean, Dennis, were you aware of how sort of backward our FA was at this point?
Yeah, nearly as backward as the FAI.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, of course, yeah, I'd have been aware of, you know, the Sir Bert Milichip era. And it was something we discussed as well with the Damned United. You know, these kind of entitled fat cats smoking cigars in oak panelled rooms and just doing what was best for them and not necessarily what was best for English football.
So then you've got the depiction of the press, and the press is sort of a stylized version of the English press of the last 20 years towards Bobby Robson, towards Graham Taylor, towards Glenn Hoddle. And you've got, again, there are direct parallels with the Taylor documentary. I don't know if any of you watched the Taylor documentary recently, but it's impossible to watch these one after the other and not see that. I mean, even down to clothing choices, genuinely.
Well, it's the trench coat on Lonnie Urquhart being Laurie McMenemy. Do you know what my favourite little parallel that I'd never clocked before until a little while ago I watched Impossible Job, and kind of it was the first time I watched it for years and years. The fact that Don't Drop Us is a direct quote, because it's a bit when Paul Gascoigne and Carlton Palmer are dicking around to the camera and Gaz is like pretending to be someone. He goes, "Oh, don't drop us, boss, drop the other fella." And it's like, that is Tonka's Don't Drop Us. And I just, never clocked that.
Yeah, this is it. And, you know, when he does get dropped at the end and he goes absolutely mental and loses it in the corridor and what have you, that's a direct parallel to when he was told he wasn't going to the 1998 World Cup. There are loads of these moments in there. The song, getting Keith Allen
to do the song. Yeah.
The whole other layer to that, and I don't know how much you know about this, Dennis, but obviously we'll be like on me head, not off me head. 1990, when New Order were putting World in Motion together, Keith Allen's sole mission was to try and get a drugs reference into the official World Cup song. So it was, you know, E is for England, England is for E, which obviously they spotted a mile away. He nearly got away with "We'll All Be in Ecstasy When We're in Italy." He genuinely, that stayed in the song for far longer than it should. So the fact that he comes round and he gets this chance and it's off me head, son, there's another gag there. And this is what I mean about the clever list. There's lots of these things from, you know, modern English football history that it references in a really quite clever way. The one that always gets me as well, it's, you know, "For the love of God, please go." You know, the newspaper headline, and when it's Phil Jupitus, I think, shouts it at him at one of the press conferences. That's obviously, you know, the Bobby Robson, the very famous Bobby Robson front page, "For the love of Allah, please go."
And of course, you know, Phil Jupitus is pretty much literally playing Rob Shepherd.
Yes,
the role that Rob Shepherd has in Impossible Job.
Yeah, cheer up, Rob. Cheer up. Smile, Rob. Smile. So it's this is what I mean about the sort of marketing and people not understanding how clever it is, and how, I mean, there's some quite like deep cut stuff in there, you know. There's stuff that I pick up on, but I consider myself like a slight obsessive, you know. There's lots and lots of this sort of thing, and the Tonka Gazza stuff, there are so many things in there that are direct or very clear allusions to some Gazza stories anyway, that, you know, like the infamous bath moment, there is a real life parallel to that, which we won't go into. And, you know, there's lots of these little nods and winks that the more I watch it and the more distance I have from it, the more I appreciate those things, I think.
Mm. Just on the song, just quickly before we move away from that, because I genuinely wish it had come out as a proper England song.
It's a good song.
I think it's great. But do you know who the lead vocalist on it is?
No, couldn't tell you.
It's a 14-year-old Lily Allen. Because you know the line about one of Atomic Kitten being ill,
Yes.
That was actually true. One of Atomic Kitten was ill when they came to film it. And in order to film it, they did literally, they went to a studio. They treated it as if they were recording an England World Cup song. So they went to the studio. All of that footage is from the day that they filmed them recording the song. But one of Atomic Kitten was ill, so the vocals weren't strong enough. So Keith Allen got Lily Allen to record vocals for it.
Yeah. But you see, again, talking about the level of detail, you know, the bit on the coach going to the first game of the World Cup, going to Egypt, there's quite I mean, again, it's sort of fairly deep dive stuff, but there's quite a famous bit of footage before England played Ireland in 1988 in the Euros where Jim Rosenthal is literally on the coach live reporting back for ITV in the warm-up to the game. And as they're driving, like, Kenny Sampson's doing various impressions. I think it's Waddle. Is it Waddle who's playing cards and all that? And that little coach drive to the Egypt game, I am almost positive they are replicating or trying to replicate footage from that little piece of camera that basically Jim Rosenthal did, because it's just almost uncanny. If you ran them side by side, I think you'd even see, like, the card game is in the same place in the coach, and, you know, I don't know, there are little things like that that I just don't think I'm sort of looking too deep in. I think there's definitely been a massive level of research has gone into this, and it has come from a place of genuine affection, but also a complete understanding of what the FA was at the time, what the press was at the time, what the England job itself was at the time. And it becomes, as I said, the more distance I have from it, it becomes quite a fascinating little snapshot, like a little time capsule, to be honest.
Do you find Dennis, as obviously not an England fan and someone who's not as immersed in England football, that I mean, I don't want to go so far as to say, like, is that a barrier? Is it harder to get into it the way that Dave has because of that?
No, I don't think nationality would be a bar to that. And maybe, I think I will watch it with the DVD commentary now when I go back, because, you know, I'm just as immersed in English football. You know, more like it's English football is at saturation levels here too. And
yeah, I mean, I don't mean to disparage your knowledge of English football.
None taken. But you know, if I watched it again, I think maybe those references would be more apparent to me, and maybe I was watching it a bit too superficially. I did think, all right, the Phil Jupitus was a very convincing hack. Certainly. And I don't know, maybe it would have been a bit too on the nose, but I would have liked that satellite link up interview, you know, with Gabby Yorath and Barry Venison, if they had made it more like the Two Ronnies sketch, you know, the mastermind one.
That's one of those where it's like the joke's been done, and if you're going to do that, you have to get a funnier joke out of it, and that seems a bit flat for me.
And I felt the presentation of the TV studio was just a bit too cheap, and I know, obviously,
it's a bit too cheap, isn't it?
Yeah,
that's one of them. You can tell they literally had a day to shoot.
And
with Gabby Logan, and
I do enjoy that. I enjoy that they've got Gabby Logan or Yorath as she was then, and Barry Venison. I think they're the right kind of duo to pick for this. I think it pitches it well.
I would agree.
I think her performance is good. I mean, she's a bit cheesy with it, but I think that's kind of deliberate. And her bit when she's running through the footage from, like, previous World Cups and the terrible, like, they are deliberately terrible presenter jokes, I think is quite good.
I
like the way that the director does talk on the commentary about how they were deliberately leaning into the suggestions of a little bit of an undercurrent of sexual tension between Gabby Yorath and Barry Venison. So.
But did you sort of pick up on things, Dennis, like at the end when they return to the airport, just how similar, again, some of the wider angles are, and some of the angles of as they go to the airport, just how similar that was to the homecoming of 1990.
I think they actually specifically use some of that footage as well. I think mixed in there is literally footage from then.
Well, it's the same airport, isn't it? It's Stansted, isn't it?
I wouldn't have been as familiar with the England team's homecoming in 1990 because the only homecoming I'm aware of from 1990 is of, you know, the champions Ireland. So, you know.
As an Irishman, you must have enjoyed the airport scene, though.
I did write that down. That was a very funny line. England B team. It was good, yeah.
That whole scene is fantastic.
It's completely unbelievable, but it's just funny, like.
I'm going to offer just before we move off the subject of the film's presentation of England and English football, I'm going to offer a bit of a criticism. And I don't know if anyone else agrees with me that the film has a bit of a problem, and it's a problem that fictional football often has, and I find it, and we probably talked about it a bit when we were talking about football comics. If your world is fictional, you kind of have to wholeheartedly lean into that. And I don't mind, like, having Pelé, for example, because, you know, Pelé can still have existed in your fictional world, and I would not want to lose the Pelé material from this film, because he's fantastic. But showing footage of the 1998 World Cup, when you're talking about Argentina, just makes you go, well, why aren't David Beckham and Michael Owen in the England team anymore?
And that was a question I had as well. When exactly did Cope take over as manager? Because you've Keegan on the wall at Lancaster Gate. So, you know, so it goes up to that game. So if Keegan was the manager, are we to assume that the England-Germany game really happened at Wembley and England conceded exactly the same goal twice in the space of a few months? That was a question that, you know, it's not unique to this film, because in the West Wing in the early seasons, I think there was a picture of Bill Clinton on the wall, and there completely should not have been.
It's always going to be a problem when you have fiction, but I think the fact that this film makes such a feature out of a couple of specific references to recent things, and it would just be stronger if it didn't have that. But actually, I tell you, its relation to recent history, I think, is, and that does bring me on to something else I was going to ask you guys and talk about, which is, so this film does take the tack very much of English football as this kind of archaic and crumbling institution, and, you know, other than the fact that obviously the team do eventually do quite well at the World Cup, there's not a lot that I think is very hopeful about its presentation of the state of English football. But I want to read out, this is a quote from I think it is from Steve Barron, the director, or it might be from one of the writers, I should have noted down who it was, talking about how obviously this film, there was a long writing period for this film, and I think that's why a lot of it is rooted in the early 90s, is that it had been being worked on since the mid 90s, and so it's from that perspective of England keep on failing. But then this quote says, so bizarrely, when the film actually came out in 2001, Sven-Göran Eriksson was in charge and he was at the height of his pomp. Everyone had become, because obviously it came out in September 2001, so I don't know if it literally got released before or after the 5-1, but it would have been around that time. So he said, everyone had become convinced that it had all changed now, that we were going to be successful and continental about it all. This bungling uselessness was all in the past. So the time it came out, almost to the month, it felt like we'd kind of missed the boat. Everything felt like it was going to be all modern and new and professional. The wheels weren't going to come off and we weren't going to have disasters. But that wasn't the case. That's why people come back to it so often, because the same disasters continue to happen. And I think that's really interesting, because I think that shows you that in 2001, in late 2001, this wasn't the right film to come out about an England team. And I wonder if that contributed to it not catching people's imagination. Whereas, you know, in 2006, or, you know, kind of particularly in 2010, it was pretty much a perfect, you know, summary of England just having no direction. So what do you feel about it, Dave, watching it in 2019, when all of a sudden, for the last year, compared with the previous decade, we're actually kind of hopeful and positive about England?
Yeah, well, this is what I mean. It becomes like a time capsule, but the way, because they sort of cherry pick from basically, I'd say from about 1986, probably from 1986 to about 1990, Well, probably just before Hoddle got there, in truth, because they cherry-pick large aspects of sort of the character and the story from that period of England management. It is a time capsule. I mean, Mike even says it himself on the plane on the way home that he's a footballing dinosaur. And it is odd to sit here as an England fan, apologies, Dennis, but to sit here as an England fan and say, well, we are actually good. I know we're sitting here at a moment in time where we've had an indifferent couple of games recently, but we're on a forward trajectory and we're finally embracing modern football. But this film was... I think you're right, but I think don't sort of overestimate the very recent history. We had that 5-1, yeah, but we were still the side that completely bumbled Euro 2000. So, you know, we managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, what, twice at Euro 2000? Mm. So we were not... I remember the 5-1. I remember the feelings around that time, and I remember it was the kickoff of all the real golden generation stuff. But there was still a feeling that all the same problems persisted. So as I said, I think now it's a wonderful little time capsule, and it's... I mean, even when it goes into the hooliganism, one of the things I really like about Mike himself is he outright condemns the hooliganism, you know, when he's, and it then turns into obviously a joke sequence, but he completely condemns it. He smacks the bigot, you know, that's the fallout with Lonnie. He smacks him. You know, he is... Through it all, he might be a footballing dinosaur, but he's still a good bloke, you know, a good solid bloke. And they could have gone another way with it, you see. They could have really lent into some of the things that were floating around about people like Terry Venables, Brian Clough. I don't want to go into it because, you still have to allegedly some of those things 20 years later. But they could have gone down that route with it, and I'm so glad that they didn't.
No, they don't. He's straight down the line, and yeah, you know, he's sort of... it doesn't mean he's not flawed, but I think it's a really key... part of making this film work is that you root for Mike. You know, and I think it's, again, I think that is it's one of those things that I think, looking back on The Impossible Job, you know, kind of at the time that it came out, everyone was so negative about Graham Taylor that the prevailing view about that documentary was that it showed what a hapless idiot Graham Taylor was.
Yeah, now go and back watch it now.
And it shows you that he's a good man trying to do the best job he can in terrible circumstances, surrounded by a pack of baying arseholes who don't deserve to have him as England manager. And I think, you know, the parallels that this film has with Taylor, there are little things like it's probably partly just a clever trick to stop them having to show or shoot a goal. But the second Poland goal in the first game at Wembley, and the camera is just on Mike, and it just follows Mike watching and then turning around. And it's so similar to a very similar moment in Impossible Job, where the camera is just on Taylor while he's watching, and you can't see what's happening on the pitch.
That's a goal. That's a goal.
And you do just get that similar. And I absolutely think that was the right way to play it. And I absolutely think Ricky Tomlinson was, you know, the right casting for that character. It's hard to imagine anybody else doing it, really.
I think this film, and Dennis, I think you'll have to agree with this, the single best piece of acting in this film is halftime of the Mexico game, which remains one of my favourite minutes of any comedy film ever.
It is wonderful.
The narration straight after England go on to lose 4-0 just makes me laugh so much.
It's the icing on the cake. I think that final line makes the scene about twice as funny as it already is.
What that scene is, what that minute is it's the... it's, again, it's writers who have watched the Peter Reid documentary, who've watched the Neil Warnock documentary, who've watched the John Sitton documentary, and rather than turn Mike into some like horrible pastiche of any of them, they managed to do it in a minute and turn it into a joke where, again, it doesn't reflect on his character, if you know what I mean. You don't come out of that thinking he's a bad guy, because again, it's just a brilliant piece of acting, because in the moment he is just so, he just loses it to such an extent that it's just pure passion and pride. It's not just like a Warnock rant, I just want to get 10% out of somebody, so I'm going to sit here and call him, you know, scream at him, and call him all the names under the sun.
By what he's seen.
He's genuinely hurt by what's happened. He's had enough. He's not going to put up with it. England go on to lose 4-0.
And I also loved when he's getting on the bus and they're shouting abuse at him. And he's like, come on, you know, give us something, be constructive. And then they're giving advice. And he says, fuck off.
Fuck off. Yeah. This film has got so many... If this film came out now, right, it would have so many memeable moments, wouldn't it?
I would agree with that.
And I think within certain football fan circles, you can say the words three cheers for Ramirez... And they'll get what you're on about, because I love that as well. This thing, so many of the best. I mean, I like the first half of the film, but I think it really comes alive when they get to Brazil. And I think so many of the strongest scenes are when they're in Brazil. And yeah, that three cheers for Ramirez is fantastic. Yeah. It is, you know. But yeah, it's so I think that to an extent it's a meme, and on a certain football forum that I won't name, but that some of us are familiar with, it's quite a well regarded and fondly remembered film, and you can reference it, and people will get what you're on about. Like there's a user on the forum whose name is Tonka as the Sixpence. So I always remember spotting. But yeah, that's what's so frustrating, is there's so many of that stuff that you're right, it would be, I think if you released this now and it didn't have any of the baggage associated with it, there's so much that people would latch onto as these great little scenes.
But if you did release it now, you wouldn't have the Rivals.net sponsorship, sadly.
No. I'd probably cut the trans panic joke as well.
Yeah, there is a bit of that, but it's not
the worst example I've seen of it in a film of or a comedy of that era. But
no, and I think again you often have to weigh these things, and when you look at, like I said, Mike eventually gets to a point where he will not put up with the bigot anymore.
Yeah,
and you know, has a go at him, and I think it puts more net good out into the world than bad.
I would agree, and I remain open to reappropriating my opinion of it. but there was something I should have watched and didn't get around to yet, and it might improve my opinion even more, but there's an alternate ending, isn't there?
Yeah, so I had a bit of a misapprehension about what the original plan for the ending was, because I thought I'd seen that the original plan for the ending was that they beat Argentina, as they do, and then they immediately get knocked out in the next round. But actually, the plan was always that the net result of England's World Cup is what you see, which is that they get all the way to the semi-final and get beaten by Brazil. But they did shoot a different ending, which they just felt didn't quite tonally cap it off right. And that's why you have that final scene on the plane, and they have to write in the line about him having a beard. And the reason for that is that Ricky Tomlinson had already started shooting something else where he needed the beard. So when they brought him back to shoot this extra scene on the plane and at the airport, he had to have the beard. So they had to have the whole thing about, I wouldn't shave if we got through to the knockout stages. But the original idea was, so the film kind of ran through the alternate ending, which you can see on the DVD, runs through the events of the rest of the tournament in pretty much the same fashion, with some kind of slightly different footage and stuff. But then it kind of follows people doesn't have the whole thing on the plane, follows various characters in a little bit. It does your kind of little documentary thing of, you know, this is where the characters were months later. We lose, sadly, the gag of Gary Wackett goes on and becomes one of the gladiators. And Rufus Smalls, it says, gets his captaincy back. on a question of sport. I think there's one or two others.
There's the brilliant one of Tonka.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Become a manager. Tonka has become a manager, Dennis, of a pub.
Yeah, there's a nice little scene with Tonka running a pub and doing an interview. And then, yeah, Mike has quit the England job and moves with his family to become the manager of Bolivia. But it's just what it shows is it shows them just there in South America, just relaxed and not under pressure. And so it's not a suggestion of, oh, he's failed at the England job and he's gone and taken this terrible job. It's he's got nothing else to prove and he's gone with his family to somewhere where they're happy and relaxed and living a nice life. And
but it also works on dual levels, doesn't it? Because obviously it also echoes Reevey leaving going to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I think it is intended as a bit of a deliberate reference to that, isn't it?
Yeah, and not only that, I was watching this today. I wonder if they did have one eye on the TV series, Seb, or potentially doing something else with Mike, and they didn't want to close it off, because it literally finishes, Dennis, with them basically saying, and he lived happily ever after. You know,
okay,
that's
that's
the thing. And watching it again, I don't know, I just had, knowing we won't go into the TV series because it was absolutely awful. But
I don't think it was horrendous, but I think if we're ever going to cover it, it deserves to be covered properly. So
Yeah, it lost what Mike Bassett actually was.
Yeah.
And I did wonder watching that. I thought, I just wonder if somebody had one eye half on a sequel, half on a TV series, half just wanting to leave it open.
Mm.
But the alternate ending is better, but I quite like the ending we've got as well, because, you know, even there they've taken the time to do the airport stuff and do it properly and have the parallels with 1990 and all that sort of thing. So at no point does it feel tacked on or rushed or something they've knocked together in a day. And I appreciate that, really.
Yeah. So of that, I mean, we talked a little bit about Ricky Tomlinson and how good he is. Across the kind of the rest of the cast, and I know, Dave, you made reference to not being super impressed with Bradley Walsh, but are there any other kind of supporting roles for either of you that stand out in terms of performances?
Jeff at the FA.
yeah,
I forget his name. Of course, he was Melin Benidorm, and when somebody says his name, I'll remember it straight away. He plays it with the right level of sort of indifference. And when he stomps down to pull Mike off the top of the bar, he gets it just about right.
Mm.
Just about right.
Geoffrey Hutchings is that actor's name, who plays Geoffrey Lightfoot. Sadly passed away in 2010.
He did,
at the age of 71.
But it's just, I should say, Bradley Walsh's performance doesn't like sort of take me out of the film or anything like that. It's just a very sort of leaden-footed performance, that's all.
I mean, as regards the rest of the cast, we mentioned him, but I think Phil Jupiter does a good, given that he's not known for doing a lot of acting, I think Phil Jupiter does a good job. I love Philip Jackson, so I love every moment that he's on screen as Lonnie. It's a shame he's kind of not in it enough, really.
Yeah, but it's good that we see from the very start he's a complete spiv, like when he sells sells Mike the banger. You know, we know he's a bit of a wrong-un.
Yeah, and then you've got various cast members from Dream Team, the likes of Robbie G and Terry Kiley filling out the players. But I actually think, aside from kind of those main people, I think where the film does its best casting is in the playing themselves guest stars. Because I think Martin Bashir does a fine job of, you know, for the most part, he is just playing himself straight. But there are a couple of little moments where he gets to send himself up a bit. And as I say, I think that, I mean, the fact that they come back to it over the credits, I think his bit with Pele is wonderful. Because yeah. you've got Pele, you know, this whole thing of like, who do you think might win the World Cup? And Pele's rattling off. And the way that Martin Bashir just goes, apart from them, it's like, anybody else? And you just go, oh yeah, sure, you know, maybe it could be like an African nation or United States. He says Yugoslavia at one point, which is a little bit weird. And then just, you know, they, what about England? England qualify? And the combination of that and his bit with the, oh Christ, it's the English. I really like what they do with Pele. Given that, you know, this is Pele in that, you know, later phase of life when he'll turn up at the opening of an envelope. You know, I don't think it's hard to get Pele to cameo in something, but I think what they really do is get the most out of him. So
you just have to leave a trail of pound coins to where you want him to go.
Yeah. And then obviously, yeah, you know, as we kind of talked about, people like Keith Allen and Gabby Logan. And I think there must be, I don't know who does kind of bespoke commentary for them. I know you get Alan Green on the radio for the Luxembourg.
Martin Tyler as well.
Yeah. It's Martin Tyler in the Argentina game, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, there's some nice kind of bits of veracity there as well. I was surprised to discover on the commentary that it is Ronaldo. Not that it is Ronaldo. We know it is Ronaldo. But I thought the Ronaldo bit was an old bit of footage that they'd repurposed for the sake of the joke when he doesn't know who Mike Bassett is. But they did actually manage to grab, for some reason, they were able to get a few minutes with original Ronaldo. And so that is bespoke footage for the film.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about favourite moments?
That was my last section that I planned to come on to next was, yes, if we sort of, having talked a lot about how it works as a football film and how it relates to football, I wanted to just talk about it as a comedy and the quality of the jokes and to just talk about some favourite moments, really. Yeah, so go for it.
I wish my dad could have seen me. He was like a father figure to me. Just such a root one joke, but gets me every time. I love the absolutely needless jibe at Scotland. That makes me laugh every single time. It's just such a needless thing.
So for those who don't know, Scotland get knocked out in the first round of the World Cup by Ethiopia.
Yes. It's such a throwaway line, but this genuinely makes me laugh every time. And a lot of people miss it, but it's when he first comes to the FA and Jeff is sort of part welcoming and he says, oh, Sir Ted would have loved to have been here, but it's dialysis day. And in one line, I've never heard something sum up our FA quite so accurately at that point in time.
I think we have covered a lot of them because we've covered things like the Born in the First Half of the Year sequence, as I say, kind of a lot of the stuff in Brazil. The Mark Lawrenson joke. I mean, I think generally, yeah. I think the Sports Science Centre stuff, the film's flagging a little bit at that point. Yeah. Although I do like Wacko getting nutted by the flying football thing. But I do like the thing of they have the dribbling machine that replicates the dribbling skill of the greatest footballers. So it's Pele, Maradona, Mark Lawrenson. Well, we ran out of money.
Yeah. Or I like as well how just the simplicity of, oh, Smallsy, you've got Charlton's lucky peg. And like it could have actually inspired him to get back scoring goals. He thought it was Bobby's one. I was like, oh, yeah, Jackie's.
I do enjoy actually just the sheer, we didn't talk about it when we were talking about the match action, but Smallsy and the penalty, because that's the film quite nicely setting up, you know, oh, this is how England heroically get to the World Cup. Smallsy's going to break his duck and score this penalty and just whacks it over the bar. Chris
and immediately puts the speed and distance graphic on it as well. That's superb. Yeah. That's a lovely touch. Well, we haven't, at no point yet, have we said the words 4-4 fucking 2.
Go on then, Dave, talk about that.
Well, the thing is about that scene is the way it's played, it's actually, it does get you going emotionally. It does get to you. And part of that is, I think, the way Ricky Tomlinson plays it. And it's the way he starts with his eyes shut and starts very quietly when he goes into the poem, If. And how he builds up a little bit and he opens his eyes and then he starts glancing around the room. And it, again, it's a really good piece of acting because you can see the sort of spine come back into him. He's had to come into this press conference in apologetic mode, but then you can see him growing as he goes through this poem. And then, of course, he gets to the end, and it's England will be playing for fucking two. And he gets out. And one of the things I love is he just walks straight through the journalists when he leaves. He walks straight through, because at that point, he's not going to take any crap. Mm. And the thing is, it's the moment everybody remembers from this film, but it still works. It still works as a cinematic moment. The line 4-4 fucking 2 is funny, but it's not necessarily even played as a gag. It's just funny in retrospect.
Mm.
And it's, yeah, I think it really, really works. I think it really does. And I'm quite interested, Dennis. What did you actually think of that scene?
I think maybe If is a little bit cliched, but maybe it wasn't as cliched back then.
Well, it's interesting that, again, they have talked about the fact that they wrote that as being the pivotal scene before the 1998 World Cup and the deadline. Okay. Michael Owen.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's probably a question of freshness, maybe. I wasn't carried away in a wave of emotion, but again, I'm not English, so maybe that's another thing. I thought it was
this tendency to get over hysterical and emotional about things.
I can't confirm or deny that. But yeah, like, I could see it was a good scene, but you know, it didn't have the same impact as maybe it could or would have had.
I remember the first time I watched the film, I was actually expecting a joke at the end of that because of the scene earlier where he's got the embroidered version of
you'll be a mason. Yeah.
And the first time I watched this, I honestly expected that he was going to end that stirring, rousing, emotional rendition by saying, "And which is more, you'll be a mason."
I was expecting that too, yeah.
I'm glad that they went with something that was better than my expected joke, but still. I realise when thinking on that scene as well that we haven't really talked about Amanda Redman in the Penny Race role. But other than the fact that she's good at the job she's given, I don't think there's a lot to say about that character.
Maybe just a little bit underutilised in that we're not shown enough of her journey to being such a discontented wife.
Yeah. Although that said, actually, she does get one of my favourite lines and deliveries now that I think about it, which is, I can't remember which club it is, it might be Crewe, but when she's talking about his journey, and so he went on loan, and then Crewe said they could keep him.
It's just a really nice...
It's simultaneously a sort of, that's not how you talk about it in football terms, but also an absolutely perfect summary of that situation of nobody wanted him. It's just a lovely little lie. They said they could keep him.
And also, the way she delivers the two words, the glamour, is just superb.
Yeah.
Oh, and actually, God, do you know what? I've just said that we haven't talked about it and she doesn't get much. Another one of the best lines in the film, when she's talking about Mike's dream being chased around Wembley Stadium by a giant Bobby Moore saying, "Look at what you've done, you bloody idiot."
Yeah.
I think that gets referenced in the alternate ending, saying that he has a better recurring dream now involving Bobby Moore. So all in all, I think obviously, Dennis, aside from the fact that you disappointed us at the start by not immediately fawning over it the way that we do, which I did kind of expect, because I think you are in line with the prevailing view. But I think at least we're all agreed that, if nothing else, the reputation that it's got as just being a kind of lame early 2000s British comedy that treats football in a really crappy way, the way a lot of British films do, isn't really justified. Like, I think if nothing else, and while there are things that we can pick, we can say that this is a film that does a good job of representing football.
Oh yeah, I would definitely agree with that, absolutely.
And even though you said it didn't make you laugh that much, we've gone through and pointed out a load of really good jokes, so
I said I laughed at some and there were others I groaned at, and I think
that Rufus Smalls couldn't hit the side of a Renault Espace. And yeah, I referenced it at the start, but I do like that bit about the fact that a car salesman is so xenophobic he doesn't know that an Opel is a Vauxhall.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just... I want to tell you what as well. Sorry, one more thing on kits, Dennis. You've got to at least admire the accurate Norwich and Leicester kits in the opening scene.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
The bit where Mike comes out and holds the board up with Zero on as well is fantastic.
Yeah. And they got good use out of their Wembley access there as well. And we haven't even talked about the open top bus thing, which is a nice little... As I say, I think generally the first half isn't as good as the second half, but there is some nice stuff in that opening. It's just a good film. I just really, really... And I think it's just really likeable. And again, I think the marketing made it look not likeable. The marketing made it look a bit cynical. And it's really not... There isn't cynicism in this film. It's a nice film about a good bloke being England manager, struggling against a load of crap, and then ultimately doing quite well. And I think that's a nice thing to have.
Agreed.
But speaking of managers who are nice guys, put into terrible, difficult situations, we need to come on to Somehow I Manage. Well, actually, unfortunately, we're not going to be coming on to Somehow I Manage, which is a shame because that was a really good segue past Seb. But yes, no, unfortunately, technical issues meant that we hadn't actually been able to do the next step of playing the game when we initially recorded this episode. So the intent was to record the segment separately after the main recording, hence me throwing over to myself the way I planned to there. Unfortunately, those issues have persisted, and also due to some other issues, we haven't been able to get the game sufficiently played and then a segment recorded in time to get this episode out, and we didn't want to delay the episode for the sake of the comedy closing segment. So Somehow I Manage will return. You'll get to find out on a future episode how Dave has done in the next stint as manager of our fictional Nottingham Forest team in Champman 97-98. But unfortunately, we won't have the chance to directly compare him to Mike Bassett on this episode. So apologies for that, and now I'm going to throw back over to a completely oblivious past version of myself. So that was Somehow I Manage. I hope that all went very well. And that was Mike Bassett, England manager, on the latest episode of Beyond the Touchline. Really hope you enjoyed listening to that. Hope if you haven't seen the film, it's inspired you to watch it. If you have, it's inspired you to go back and rewatch it and reevaluate it, as I'm sure Dennis will be doing immediately after the episode. If this is your first time listening to us and you enjoyed this and want to hear more, you can find all of the episodes of the show at beyondthetouchline.co.uk. You'll find links there to subscribe to us. We are on Acast. You can find us on the Acast app. Obviously, we're on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and we're also on Spotify. You can find us on there and generally in your podcast app of choice. But all the links are there, on as well as direct episode listening embeds on beyondthetouchline.co.uk. And there's a link to our Twitter account, which is BTTL Podcast. If you've got anything you want to say about the show, the podcast, things that we've covered, things that we might cover, please do get in touch with us. I'm at Seb Patrick on Twitter. Dave is at David Hartrick, and Dennis is at Dennis_Hurley. So again, if you want to shout at us about our opinions, please do feel free to get in touch there. And if you are enjoying the show, standard plea for a podcast, but please leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, because that really does help. But apart from that, that's about it from us. I don't think we've decided, once again, what our next episode's going to be. So we'll just leave that as a nice surprise. But we hope you will join us for whatever it is when we come back in about a month or so's time. So thank you from and to Dave.
Thank you.
And from and to Dennis.
Thank you for having me on, and hopefully I'll be allowed on again, even though my feelings for Mike Bassett aren't as strong as the pair of you.
Thanks, guys. That was very enjoyable. I've been Sir Patrick, and we'll see you again soon. Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.